First, the headlines. Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid tensions following its air raids on Lebanon that prompted Hezbollah's retaliatory rocket attacks. Iran's ambassador to the UN calls on the Security Council to reject Israel's deceptions and confront its adventurism in the region. Also coming up, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security warns of a growing threat of violence from supporters of former President Donald Trump. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli aircraft have carried out fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the town of Jabalia. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon. He gave us an update on the latest round of aggression by the Israeli regime.
Israeli fighter jets attacked the Hamas security post in the northern Gaza Strip town of Jabalia minutes after midnight, causing extensive damage to that security post and also to nearby homes. Meanwhile, Israeli fighter jets continue to fly at low altitude in the skies of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime claims that the air attacks were retaliation for incendiary balloons that were dispatched from the Gaza Strip earlier. Many here believe that Israel will continue such attacks against the Palestinians in Gaza because of the apathy of the international community, and also because of the fact that Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, have normalized their ties with Israel, given the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of Palestinians. And understand it's been almost 2 months since Israel ended its 11-day onslaught against the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming hundreds of Palestinians in this impoverished enclave and destroying thousands of residential units.
The Israeli arms firm, which operates in Britain, has been targeted by a group of pro-Palestine activists who occupied the company's headquarters in London. They're trying to force a change of British policy towards Israel and end the immoral arms sales to the regime with Palestinian blood on its hands. Rob Carter was on the scene and witnessed the stunt.
Pro-Palestine activists struck again in central London on Friday, occupying the entrance to the UK headquarters of Israeli arms firm Elbit Systems. The protesters lit flares, graffitied windows, and sprayed the walls with red paint to symbolize the blood of Palestinian civilians killed by Israeli aggression.
This is just the latest in a long line of radical action for the Palestinian cause, as these activists from Palestine Action feel that there is absolutely no alternatives left in order to try and force a change for the oppressed Palestinian people.
Elbit Systems are one of the biggest arms manufacturers based in the UK. They are infamous for producing weapons which are sold to brutal regimes, which use these arms to target civilians. Saudi Arabia and Israel are just two examples.
Palestine Action has been launched for just over a year now. It was our 1 year anniversary just last week. Since then, there have been actions of Palestine Action all over Elbit sites across the country. So Elbit Systems is our largest arms company, and they actually market their weapons as battle tested, which means that they've been tested on the Palestinian population of Gaza, the captive population of Gaza, where the majority of the people there are children and the majority are refugees who've been displaced from other parts of Palestine. So we essentially have Israel's largest arms company making and building their weapons here. They have two headquarters in England, one in London and one in Bristol. But this is a key part of their operations in order to be able to conduct these deals, which often lead to the death of innocent civilians all across the world.
Palestine Action have admitted that despite the risks their volunteers face, they have an endless waiting list of activists waiting to risk life and limb. Unless the killing of Palestinians stops, they too refuse to stop. Robert Carter, London.
The U.S. has called on the Lebanese government to prevent Hezbollah resistance movement from firing rockets into Israel. The call by the U.S. State Department comes after Hezbollah's deputy chief, Sheikh Naim Wassam, said that the movement is prepared to hit Israel again if the regime launches new attacks on Lebanon. Hezbollah fired dozens of rockets at open areas around Israeli-occupied Sheba farms on Friday. The movement said that the rocket fire was in response to Israel's airstrikes. Lebanon's parliament speaker backed Hezbollah's move, saying that Israel only understands the language of unity and resistance.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabah farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land, or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, the status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says the U.S. government is, in fact, dominated by Israeli policies and its propaganda campaign.
In fact, it should be the Lebanese government, of which Hezbollah is part, calling on Washington to stop its unconditional support for Israeli aggression. Unfortunately, the American government is largely dominated by the Israeli government. They put the aggressor in the position of the defender and the defender in the position of the aggressor. And this is the way it's always been with the Zionist propagandists. So nobody takes this seriously, what comes out of the mouth of somebody like Biden or this administration.
Iran's ambassador to the UN has called on the Security Council to reject Israel's deceptions and to confront its adventurism in the region. In a tweet, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi noted that the Israeli regime and its allies made an abortive attempt to present fake information on the Mercer Street tanker incident to the council. The U.S. has claimed that evidence shows last week's attack on the Israeli-managed tanker was conducted by a drone made in Iran. The foreign ministers of the G7 have echoed the claim, first made by Israel. Iran has rejected the allegation, saying that Israel is trying to divert world attention from its crimes and inhumane practices in the region. Tel Aviv says that it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. Iran has warned of a crushing response to any such move. Political commentator Alexander Azadgan says Israel has resorted to deception to wage a war against Iran.
What is really going on is the Israelis are implementing their old tactic of waging war through deception. Many people believe this was Mossad's logo, but it's not correct. Nevertheless, the Israelis are very keen on starting wars under false pretext, false flag operations in order to pursue their foreign policy. I mean, they haven't really provided any evidence. And in previous situations where we asked for evidence, journalists, investigative journalists, they said we can't disclose the evidence.
Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, says that the ones who are seeking normalization of ties with Israel will soon realize their mistake, as the Zionist regime has never been committed to any agreement. Raisi made the remark in a meeting with the Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Talal Naji, on Friday. He said resistance is the only way to victory against Israel, stressing the need for unity among all factions of resistance movement. Halal Naji, for his part, hailed Iran's efforts to preserve stability and security in the region. Raisi took the oath of office on Thursday to be officially inaugurated as Iran's eighth president. So far, he has held several meetings with officials from different countries. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has warned of a growing threat of violence from supporters of former President Donald Trump. The department says it has witnessed an increasing but modest level of activity online by those who called violence over claims of fraud in the presidential election last year. It says that there is no information yet on specific plots, but some actions may happen during August. The administration of President Joe Biden has already warned about the rising threat of militias and white supremacists in the coming months. The warnings about possible domestic terrorism come against the backdrop of the storming of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. by pro-Trump mobs. On January 6, Trump fans burst into Congress in an attempt to overturn his election defeat. The incident left five people dead. A former New York State employee has filed a complaint against Governor Andrew Cuomo over sexual harassment, increasing the possibility that he might be charged. The woman has not been named, but is set to work as an aide to Cuomo. She said the three-term governor assaulted her at his executive mansion last year. Her allegation is part of an explosive report released this week that said Cuomo sexually harassed 11 former and current state employees. At least five district attorneys have since opened inquiries into Cuomo's behavior. The 63-year-old Democrat has repeatedly denied ever touching a woman inappropriately. Democratic senators and families of the 9/11 victims are calling on U.S. President Joe Biden to declassify documents detailing Saudi Arabia's role in the terrorist attacks. The families say that Biden has failed to fulfill its campaign promise to release information on the 2001 attacks. They say 20 years after the attacks, there is simply no reason to keep this information secret. The group has threatened to publicly stand against the Biden administration's participation in the next month's memorial ceremonies unless the information is released. Meanwhile, chair of the Senate's Foreign Affairs Committee backed the push. Bob Menendez said that the bereaved families have a right to know if the government is sitting on documents implicating Saudi Arabia or others in the attacks. 15 of the 19 9/11 attackers were Saudi nationals. Back in 2004, a commission found charities funded by the Saudi government likely supported the attacks. Journalist and commentator Mike Harris believes that the U.S. Democrats' call for declassification of documents on the 9/11 attacks is a sheer stunt for political gains.
Every American has the right to know what really happened on 9/11. It's pretty obvious to anyone who's done a study of the 9/11 events that the official government story that 19 Arab hijackers in airplanes brought down the Twin Towers or attacked the Pentagon when there was no debris at the Pentagon at all above an aircraft. Something else happened that day. And by releasing what we have on the Saudis, a lot of other parties may be implicated in this. And the reason the Democrats are doing this at this time is the Democrat Party is feeling a great deal of pressure from the audits that are going on because of the stolen election. And the stolen election is going to affect much, much more than just the Biden presidency, but also all the down ticket races. And many of these Democrats who are there may no longer be in office after their malfeasance and the theft of this election is coming out. So they're trying to create an issue to take the focus off of the election theft. And 9/11 is a perfect excuse because Republicans were responsible for the cover-up.
The Bolivian president has pledged to punish those accused by the government of an alleged coup in 2019 when the former leader Evo Morales lost power.
We will not stop demanding the prosecution and punishment of the perpetrators of the coup d'etat, who must be brought to justice for the illegal, illegitimate, and violent acts they committed against the people, democracy, and the political constitution of the state.
Luis Arce added that every effort should be made to end the political crisis caused by those who staged the coup in collusion with international accomplices to repress Bolivians. Morales stepped down as president in November 2019 after weeks of protest against his re-election. Morales quit after losing the support of the military amid an alleged electoral fraud. His resignation was followed by clashes between his supporters and security forces, which left dozens dead. Conservative Jeanine Añez assumed the interim presidency until new elections were held. The conflict in Ethiopia's flashpoint Tigray state escalates as rebels rebuff a federal government call to pull out of recently captured areas in the region. The government accuses forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front of threatening the June ceasefire. The foreign ministry said the rebels were pushing the government to change its defensive mood. It also warned that Addis Ababa could deploy, quote, the entire defensive capability of the state if a peaceful resolution is not reached. The rebels have taken full control of several areas of Afar and Amhara regions in recent weeks, claiming they are trying to break the government's blockade on Tigray. The state has been the scene of fighting between the federal army forces and rebels since last November. Hundreds of people have been killed and tens of thousands of others displaced. Australia's New South Wales state has reported another record number of daily coronavirus cases. The state registered 319 infections on Saturday, its highest daily case numbers since the outset of the pandemic. This is the third straight day of record cases, mostly in the state's capital, Sydney. There were also five more deaths. The virus continues to spread through Sydney's sprawling suburbs, despite the city heading into its seventh week of a lockdown. Officials said that residents appear to be ignoring restrictions and urged them to stay at home. According to authorities, the city of Armidale would also join around 60% of Australia's 25 million residents already under stay-at-home orders. Meanwhile, concerns are growing over the COVID outbreak in the city of Melbourne and Victoria State. The Victoria Premier described the new outbreaks as, quote, very significant. He said that there are almost certainly more cases in the community than reported. He called on the resident to get tested when they get any symptoms. Victoria State has already returned to lockdown Thursday for the sixth time since the pandemic began. A lack of supply and pockets of vaccine hesitancy are said to have hampered efforts to immunize Australians. Just over 20% of the population has been fully vaccinated. And that is it for World News.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour for the past 12 years, despite years of debate over a raise to $15 per hour and a recent focus in Congress on increasing wages. Even if that increase was implemented, it is no longer enough to support the average American family. A new report from USA Facts shows that single-earned households making $15 an hour would take 2 years working every weekday to make what the average family spends annually. The article you're about to hear has been written by Braden Waddell, a journalist writing for US News and World Report. The piece is titled, report, $15 hourly wage isn't livable anywhere in the United States. Federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour for the past 12 years, despite years of debate over a raise to $15 per hour and a recent focus in Congress on increasing wages. Even if that increase was implemented, it is no longer enough to support the average American family. A new report from USA Facts shows that single-earner households making $15 an hour would take 2 years working every weekday to make what the average family spends annually. The analysis focuses on the middle 20% of income earners and compares a $15 an hour wage to the average family's expenses, such as healthcare, food, and housing, using the data compiled from the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the Bureau of Labor, and the Census Bureau from 2018, the most recent year with full data. Among those U.S. households, 71% rely primarily on a single earner for the family. Although average family expenses differ from state to state, the data shows that no family relying on a single $15 hourly income could afford average annual expenses anywhere in the United States. In Mississippi, the state with the lowest average family expenses, it would take 72 full work weeks at $15 an hour to cover expenses, and the state's current minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. In Washington, D.C., with the highest average family spending, it would take more than 2.5 years. Only 9 states and Washington, D.C. have or are in the process of implementing a $15 per hour minimum wage, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Even if a $15 federal minimum wage was signed into law, American families relying on a single minimum wage earner would only bring in about half the money needed to cover average basic expenses each year. Although many states are on track to increase their minimum wages to between $10 to $13 an hour, basic necessities such as rent on a 2-bedroom apartment would require an hourly take-home pay of $24.90 per hour just to be affordable. President Joe Biden included an increase in the minimum wage in an early version of the American Rescue Plan Act, but it was removed from the final text. In an executive order in April, President Biden required federal contractors to pay their employees $15 per hour by March 2022. The United States says federal minimum wage has been $7.25 per hour since 2009. Many states implement higher minimum wages, and several are scheduled to increase theirs to $15 per hour in the next 5 years. Still, a renter in the United States would need to earn $20.40 per hour on average to afford a modest 1-bedroom rental home in 2021, according to this year's edition of the National Low Income Housing Coalition's Out of Reach report. That figure increases to $24.90 per hour for a standard 2-bedroom rental unit, the report says. And as the nation navigates a bumpy economic recovery in the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic, experts say the job losses brought about by the coronavirus and public health emergency disproportionately impacted workers who could least afford a blow to their incomes. This pandemic was an economic catastrophe for low-wage workers and people of color. Dan Threet, a research analyst at the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, told U.S. News & World Report. Dan Threet says many low-wage workers are housing cost-burdened, meaning they're unable to spend less than 30% or in some cases 50% of their earnings on rent. When you're housing cost-burdened, you're not able to save for unexpected emergencies, he said. A shutdown or furlough can have reverberating effects and can be indicative of how those low-wage workers were much more likely to fall into a precarious situation. West Virginia and Arkansas rank lowest among U.S. states for housing costs, with average benchmark housing wages of $14.83 and $14.60 per hour, respectively. Still, with hourly minimum wages of $8.75 in West Virginia and $11 per hour in Arkansas as of 1st of July 2021, the estimate is that it will take 68 hours per week of minimum wage work in West Virginia and 53 hours of weekly minimum wage work in Arkansas to afford a standard two-bedroom rental home. California, Hawaii, and Massachusetts have the most prohibitive housing wages for a two-bedroom apartment, $39.03, $37.69, and $36.24 per hour, respectively, according to the report. Next are New York, the District of Columbia, and New Jersey, followed by Washington, Maryland, Colorado, and Connecticut to complete the top 10.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at Israel in response to the regime's airstrikes. The Lebanese president has denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and stability of the region, and the country's parliament speaker has said Israel only understands the language of unity and resistance. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at the reasons behind the recent Israeli escalation and the significance of Hezbollah's response to the aggression.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabaa farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely higher state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006, whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Well, joining us, we have Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, Mr. Jamal Wakim, joining us from Beirut. And also, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, is joining us from the British capital, London. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Wakim in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Wakim, how do you view the escalation of tensions, and also what are your views on the timing of all of this?
Well, I believe that what happened was an attempt by the new Israeli Prime Minister, Bennett, to prove himself stronger than his predecessor, Netanyahu, by changing the rules of engagement with Lebanon. So that's why he capitalized on an incident of firing two rockets on occupied Palestine to wage or to escalate the situation by waging air raids for the first time since 2014. And this was the response of the Islamic resistance was to wage this attack, which put things back to square one in this regard, because the Israelis didn't dare to react to this, and they chose to downgrade their reaction, and they didn't attack back. So that's why I believe that Bennett got embarrassed, and now he's facing mounting criticism inside Israel, especially from supporters of Netanyahu, who used this to as a mean to attack Bennett, who, because Bennett himself used to criticize Netanyahu for not escalating his attacks against Lebanon in reaction to, let's say, launching rockets from Lebanese territories. So I believe that this was the reason why the new government, the new prime minister, was trying to test the ground and see if he can fare better than his predecessor facing the Islamic resistance. However, it proved him wrong, and he had to back down on this.
Sayed Mohsen Abbas in London. Hezbollah said the rockets were in retaliation for the Israeli attacks. A while back, if you recall, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he said that they now had twice as many precision-guided missiles as they did a year ago. Has the capacity of resistance forces to respond changed the equation for the Israeli regime now?
It's changed it for a considerable amount of time. I mean, since 2006, Hezbollah has increased its capacity, both in terms of quality of military on the ground capability, but also with weaponry. They were particularly skilled in the 2006 war at using anti-tank weapons. Their light infantry was known to be in many ways superior to Israel on their home ground. The tactics that they used were extraordinarily effective in pushing back the Israeli invasion. In fact, Naftali Bennett was one of the soldiers who actually was a commanding officer within that invasion, and was also the victim of a defeat, and a bitter defeat. So some of this may well be also to do with him wanting to sort of readdress unfinished business, if you like. But the reality on the ground is this: that Hezbollah has the armed strength of a medium-sized army. Nobody knows the full capacity of weaponry and arsenal and power they have now. That's not something which certainly either Israel or anybody else can make a firm estimate on. Groups like the James group, they've assessed that Hezbollah has more than 25,000 full-time fighters and perhaps around 30,000 reservists. But all this is guesswork. What they do know is that Hezbollah has now also got skills in terms of maneuvers, strength of being able to maneuver in conventional warfare, given their experience in Syria and fighting ISIS and the Zio Western proxies out there. So there's no I think delusion on the part of the Israeli Defense Force that they're up against a very skilled, very motivated, very pious fighting force. You're not dealing with an ordinary army when you're talking about Hezbollah. These men are not just fighting for land. They have an ideological and spiritual commitment to defending the oppressed, which goes beyond your average soldier. They're certainly not in it for the money or being paid for by the American or the Israelis. And they're certainly not children or kids being conscripted by force to serve in the IDF. So overall, Israel may be testing the ground. They've been given their answer. I think that they'd be wise to take note and not continue any further aggressions on the Lebanese sovereignty.
Mr. Wakim, the recent attack on the Israeli tanker off the coast of Oman, that was seen as a response to the Israeli regime's hostile activity. Are regional resistance forces conveying the message now that there will be consequences for Israel's hostile behavior?
Well, I believe that this is true, because Israel is taking an all-out, attack on the resistance movements. However, the attack on Israeli tanker in the Sea of Oman is a clear message that Israeli aggressions will not pass without reaction. So this is very important. And at the same time, I believe that what's happening cannot be, in Lebanon, for example, is not detached from what's going on in the Sea of Oman or elsewhere in the Middle East.
Sure. Said Mohsen Abbas, the Arab League, in a statement noted that the practices of the new Israeli administration headed by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are meant to display its force. That's something that Mr. Wakim also alluded to. Do you think that could have been the initial move for the new Israeli Prime Minister? And given the response now, are the Israelis in a dichotomy as to whether they should escalate their attacks or not?
It certainly will be a part of the play, but don't forget the Islamic Republic of Iran has had just had a change of guard. The new president, Ayatollah Raisi, is now firmly in office. So generally, the Israelis are in a high state of nervousness. They understand that what's happening in Islamic Republic of Iran and what's happening even in Lebanon and in Yemen and in Syria is all, and of course Iraq as well, not to forget Iraq, is all ultimately focused with them in mind. The fact of the matter is the rising power, the rising strength, the rising unity of the Arab world, and including, of course, Iran as well in West Asia, is, of course, hugely worrying. Never before have the Israelis, not since certainly before Yom Kippur, the war back in the 70s, have they actually faced an adversary that was really, truly capable of challenging them, and they know this. Now, they're in a real quandary. If you don't go for the resistance axis, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Lebanon, of course, Hezbollah, if you don't take an action against them now as an Israeli military or even as a sort of a broader NATO, American, etc., alliance as well, then they're going to be calculating, the strategists in Israel will be calculating that this force will only grow. It'll only become more powerful. So what do you do? Do you tackle the resistance axis now and try to finish it off or push it back? Or do you just wait and hope that there isn't the strength within the resistance axis to ever actually fully take on Israel toe-to-toe in an open war? Well, this is between a rock and a hard place, really, for Israel. And they are really, I think, very, very confused as to what they ought to do. You can see they've been rattling the sabers, trying to draw in the world. That's what the language has been over this Sea of Oman issue that was raised. They've been trying to rally them to all come and attack Iran. Well, the fact is that they couldn't defeat Hezbollah and Lebanon in a 22-day war. They couldn't defeat the Palestinian resistance in a even shorter lived folly that most recently. What chance would they stand against the entire Islamic resistance axis if they were to rattle that little, nest of, hornets, if you from their point of view? I don't think that they really know what they're doing. So what they've actually been doing, and this military show is an act of bravado, but what they've been doing more cunningly, of course, don't forget, is that they've been trying to instigate civil war in Lebanon. They've the death of Ali Shibli, for instance, at a wedding, shot down by some extremist chaps, Ahmed Gonsa, I think the name of the gentleman is, who actually killed Ali Shibli, who was a member of Hezbollah, who was an active member, is one of those kind of incidents which is designed to stir tension, to create sectarian aggravations, and also, of course, to test Hezbollah. Hezbollah's been very cool and calm, and the whole incident has been toned down. But color revolution has been added to this desire to create sectarian civil war. That's been going on the back of the economic sanctions, which again are instigated by the Anglo-Zionist axis to try and bring Lebanon to its knees. So all of these things are going on: sabotage, proxy politicians within Lebanon, the economic sanctions, color revolutions. You know, they've tried everything to try and break Lebanon because primarily Hezbollah sits on their doorstep and they don't like it. And that's their main priority, is to try and divide and destroy their key opposition in the region.
Professor Waqeem, the Arab League, as we're staying on that topic, warned that escalating hostilities between Lebanon and Tel Aviv regime could spiral out of control, adding that Lebanon has been passing through a difficult time and could not endure more tensions. When will these platitudes and mere words end? When will there be tangible action from the likes of the Arab League?
Well, I don't believe that there will ever be an action by the Arab League. The Arab League was first installed in 1945 by the British as an umbrella to control the Arab states and put them all the time under British and later on under American hegemony. So that's why I don't, throughout its history, except for the period in the 1950s and 1960s when Nasser ruled Egypt, but throughout its history, the Arab League was always a mirror of the Western resolutions and an accessory of British and then U.S. Policies in the region. So that's why we saw that all its resolutions would always fall in the benefit of the U.S. policies in the region. And this was best featured in the past three decades, whether in the blockade imposed by the U.S. on Iraq, later by its inability to oppose the invasion, the American invasion of Iraq, and then the conspicuous role of the Arab League in justifying many resolutions taken against Arab countries that are not abiding by the Western will, most important Syria, and the conspicuous role of the Arab League in Syria in this regard. So we don't count on the Arab League to stand as an independent actor, and we don't count on its resolutions whenever it comes to confronting Israel by an Arab country or by the Islamic resistance.
Said Mohsen Abbas, the Lebanese caretaker prime minister, has called on the UN to exert some pressure on the Israelis to halt its aggression on Lebanon. Are you expecting to see any response from the UN? The UN peacekeeping mission in Lebanon has also warned the situation is very dangerous. That's even more of a reason for the UN to take action now.
Well, the UN has proven itself to be a toothless tiger. It really is a defunct organization in terms of being able to prevent wars, that's for sure. They might have some arguments to say in terms of helping people who are victims of wars, etc. They may be able to go and do things like that, but really they have no say and they have no power. You have a veto in the UN, which belongs to the Americans, and the Americans will use that veto every time to favor Israel, to prevent any progress or any justice or fairness being exercised in that region. This is just a reality. In fact, the Americans have exercised that veto dozens and dozens of times, more for Israel than any other veto. That's the American track record. So you've got a block there. The UN just won't do anything. They can go through sort of platitudes and make noises and say how dangerous things are, but really they are not the answer. In fact, no international organization really is the answer. There is only one answer, and Ayatollah Khamenei, Sayyid Nasrallah have all pointed to this. The only language they understand, the Israelis and the Anglo-Zionist axis, is military and hard power. And I think that's the direction that Hezbollah went after seeing Israel's constant efforts to invade Lebanon. And they build up tactical strengths. They have, you know, fantastic skills in cover and concealment in their own territories, you know, in that terrain of South Lebanon, etc. They are great with direct fire, preparation of their fighting positions. They've got lots of fabulous, fighters who are very capable of taking out tanks, and the Israelis' much-wanted tank squadrons were heavy blows. So I don't see Israel making this calculation. Even though they've got aerial power, aerial support, I don't think they can contemplate a head-on war with Hezbollah. 150,000 missiles, by their own admission, are sitting, waiting for any move that Israel makes. Now, you don't know what the scale of those ballistic missiles or those weapons are, because having been linked to Iran, goodness knows whether they've got the Bavar, or whether they've got all the other, wonderful array of arsenal, which Iran has been very publicly showing and actually demonstrated to America, too, indeed, as to what it was capable of.
All right, one last question for Mr. Wakim. We've got probably less than a minute. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabi Berri, he said that the Israelis only understand the language of unity and resistance. How important are these two elements, unity and resistance, when it comes to opposing the Israeli regime?
Well, I believe that this is very important. They have proved very important in the past four decades. Of course, power and strength, most important. Unity in Lebanon, too bad. We were never able to achieve unity, and the Islamic resistance had to pass through a lot of difficulties in the past four decades because of the lack of unity. But despite of this, it was able to achieve major victories over the Israelis, and that's why we believe that we will achieve victory in any confrontation that will occur in the future.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University, joining us from Beirut. And also thanks to Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, a special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن
Allah
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio is our dear guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is a researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us yet again, dear Sheikh. So our topic deals with a misconception, perhaps, or some skepticism that is very prevalent in especially Western societies, but we also see the same logic or questioning also in the Islamic society. And the conception, misconception, or the question is as follows. We believe that there is a creator, we accept that, but we say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or those who are of this belief, say that He created the universe, He created everything, but then He left it alone to do its own thing. And they say it is just like a computer. A person, he invents a computer or a computer program, he programs it, and then he leaves it alone. And then it can do whatever it is. And that God therefore has maybe forsaken the world, He has left it alone, and left it to do whatever it needs, because they believe that there is no need for a creator to interfere in everything that we do. It is too much, because the system that He has created can govern itself. It can continue on its own. For example, like the ecological system of rain, of how rain functions. It rains and evaporates and it becomes rain again. We do not need an architect for every single step of the way. Dear Sheikh, is this correct?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, it has been mentioned by different groups in the history of humankind. In the history of Islam, we have some people who believe in this. Some verses of the Quran, it seems that they are referring to the fact that among the Jews, some people believe in that. We have a school called Deism in the West, and they also believed in this. They are referring to a person who makes clocks or watch, and then the clock or the watch works
on its own
and without any need to the maker. Now, let me give you an introduction. In Islam, we believe in Tawheed and monotheism, and there are four understanding of Tawheed or monotheism. One of them is called a Tawheed al-Dhati, referring to the fact that the essence of God is, we have only one God, and the essence of God is not comprised of different parts. Then we have Tawheed in creation, the fact that it is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who created every creature. Then we have Tawheed in Ubudiyyah, the fact that we only need to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Then we have Tawheed in Rububiyyah, the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the only one who is controlling the whole world. So according to Islamic understanding, we believe in the fact that for every moment this world is in need of God for its continuity.
For governance and governorship, yeah, and continuance.
If for a moment, I mean, if you imagine that for a moment Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala forsakes the whole world, then all at once it would disappear. So this is Islamic understanding. Now, first of all, my question from these people is that when you say that it is like a computer, the question is that, so the one who has designed the computer, he has designed everything. So is there anything which is done by the computer which is, against or outside the design of the designer? I believe that the computer, whatever is happening inside the computer, it is in line with the design of that designer.
Or the instructions given to it by the designer.
So my first point is that, okay, let's accept your, analogy and simile. The world is like a computer, but everything that is done in this world is in line with the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, because they want to say that what is going on after the creation has nothing to do with the will of God, is working on
its own.
But my point is that the computer, although seemingly it may work on its own, but it does not work beyond the program which was given to it by the designer.
It has limitations.
Yeah, it has limitations. And so this simile does not give this conclusion that the world is working, without any need to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. My first point is that even if we accept this simile, the world is working in a way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has willed. So still we cannot say that there is no tawheed in rububiyyah. No, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is controlling the world. He has the full control. You may say that he has controlled everything before and now it is working, or right. As we say, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is controlling moment by moment.
At the end of the day, he's still controlling it.
Yeah, he's controlling. So my point is that even if you accept this simile, the conclusion is wrong, because the computer is not working against the instructions given to it by the designer. But the second point is that, again, I believe that those who have given this example, they have not known computer too. Not only they do not go God, they do not know computer. From time to time, we know that the computer is in need of its designer. Let's give the example of virus and antivirus and so on and so forth.
Windows, for example, it's an operating system that continually is updated, so it can continue functioning.
It should be updated. So from time to time, or on a daily basis, big computers are in need of the designers. And now imagine the whole world, how big and huge is this computer.
So many variables and situations and happenings and events. And a computer, it is in essence only ones and zeros.
Yeah.
That's how it is programmed.
Yeah.
You cannot compare it to the universe, yet alone the world.
So again, this example that you have mentioned is helping us to claim that still we need that designer, like the computer, which is in need of the designer. The next point is that you claim that you believe in a creator, because they say that he has created the world and then he left it to work on its own. Now the question is that, is this creator a wise creator? I think their answer must be positive. So if he's a wise creator, then we come to the